All right, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 650 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, we're going to focus on nutrition, right? Nutrition and the USMLEs. As many of us know, the USMLEs, I mean, they've always tested nutrition. I don't know why this is such a big shocker to people. But the thing is, basically, across step one, step two, CK, and step three, starting in June of this year, they're going to start testing, nutrition in a more enhanced fashion, if you may. So I just kind of want to talk through many of the key concepts so that you're kind of ready for your exams. So I'm going to call this the USMLEs and nutrition, right? And again, remember, nutrition is not just about biochemistry, right? That's probably like the big bent that they used back in the day, right? But the USMLEs, they are basically moving toward testing, whether, future physicians can connect nutrition science to like patient care, like preventing disease and things like that. You're going to see, I'm not going to do any political anything, right? I'm going to hit on the things that are high yield, right? And again, I think it's kind of important to keep some key things in mind, just statistically, right? Like diet is one of the leading causes of death, right? Diet is linked to cardiovascular disease, which we know is the most common cause of death, right? Diet is linked to cancer, right? Because the thing is, all these things are related, like your diet to high blood pressure, to obesity, to diabetes, to pre-diabetes, and all those things, right? So it's just key to keep these things in mind. Now, I'll say the USMLEs with regards to nutrition, what are some key things they love to emphasize for each of the concepts? Number one, what's the mechanism, right? Number two, how do you manage this problem, right? Number three, what should you look for? Like, what are the key things you should look for that should make you realize that this patient has this problem, right? So I think the first thing I want to talk about here as a foundation for all of this are the difference between macro and micronutrients, right? Again, you may think some of these things are like filler, but you'd be surprised by how they go after these, right? So remember, macronutrients are like the big foods, right? Like your carbs, your proteins, your fiber, your fat, right? And then micronutrients are more of your vitamins and minerals, right? And remember, there is all these different diets that the USMLEs love to emphasize, right? So like, for example, diets that have been shown to really help with cardiovascular disease are things like the Mediterranean diet, things like the DASH diet, right? DASH stands for Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension, right? Remember, the DASH diet is actually very effective for lowering a person's blood pressure. Although, let me ask you this, what is the most effective intervention for lowering blood pressure? Lifestyle intervention. I hope you're saying weight loss, right? So remember, weight loss is number one. It's more effective than the DASH diet, right? But the DASH diet helps not just with high blood pressure. It also helps with cardiovascular disease, right? But the Mediterranean diet has also been shown to lower blood pressure and also lower a person's risk for cardiovascular disease, right? And then don't forget that if you want to reduce a person's risk of having like colorectal problems and also lowering their cholesterol, a high fiber diet is very, very helpful for those kinds of people, right? Or if they give you a question about a person that has heart failure, right, then a low sodium diet is going to be very, very helpful for those kinds of people, because if you pursue a low sodium diet, that's going to reduce your volume overload, and that's going to be very, very helpful, right? So the thing is, it's very important on your exams to recognize that, hey, for this particular kind of patient, this particular kind of diet will be helpful in ameliorating their problems, right? And then another classic set of things they also love to test are the different kinds of food processing, right? So remember, like, there's foods that are unprocessed, there's foods that are minimally processed, there's foods that are ultra processed, right? Ultra processed foods obviously are going to be the worst of the bunch, right? And why are ultra processed foods so bad? Well, the thing is, many times a lot of the key nutrients that were in the original food have been stripped off. And then number two, another reason why ultra processed foods are also bad is because many times you use all these industrial ingredients that are like not natural, so the body cannot process them very well, right? And some of those things are linked to deleterious health consequences, right? So just something you want to keep at the back of your mind for your exams, right? And then also you want to make sure you know about the vitamins and the key high yield points about the vitamins, right? So remember, like vitamin A, for example, we know that vitamin A is necessary for the maintenance of specialized epithelium, right? Like epithelium you find like in the eye, for example, right? So the thing is, if a person has a vitamin A deficiency, don't be surprised. The person is going to have, like, they may present it as a person having an accident at night. right? Accident at night, you know, or they cannot read things very well, you know, at night, right? Because it can cause night blindness. It can cause xerophthalmia, right? XeroPhthalmia, right? You know, make sure you can identify betel spots on fundoscopic exam on your exams, right? And then, you know, vitamin B1, I'm just kind of going alphabetically, vitamin B1, remember Wernicke, Korsakoff, beriberi, right? And you may wonder, like, why does vitamin B1 deficiency cause all these problems? Well, the thing is, vitamin B1 is thiamine, right? And again, if you remember from step one, thiamine is used for many things, right? Like, we use it for the pyruvate dehydrogenase complex, and we use it for the TCA cycle, right? The Krebs cycle, right? So, especially in the form thiamine pyrophosphate, right? Thiamine pyrophosphate, right? So, the thing is, if you have issues with thiamine, right, then these reactions are not going to work, right? Your pyruvate dehydrogenase complex, your TCA cycle, and those are energy generating pathways, right? So if those energy generating pathways do not work, then tissues that use high amounts of energy are going to struggle. Well, what are some examples of these tissues? Things like your heart, things like the brain, right? If you notice, when people have antecedents of thiamine deficiency, like beriberi or Wernicke-Korsakoff, if you notice, many times their symptoms are centered around the heart and neurologic tissue, because those two kinds of tissues use high amounts of energy, right? So, like, for example, people can have wet beriberi. It's called wet because, again, they don't have good energy production with their cardiac myocytes, right? So their heart doesn't have very good pump function, so they can start having heart failure, right? And when you have heart failure, you're going to have edema, right? So hence the term wet beriberi, right? Wernicke-Korsakoff, right? Parts of the brain that use high amounts of energy, like the thalamus, the hypothalamus, the mammillary bodies, those things can have infarctions, right? Because, again, there's not enough energy, right? So keep that in mind with vitamin B1. And then vitamin B3, again, you're like, oh, Divine, there's vitamin B2. The thing is, for the US Emily's and nutrition, vitamin B2 probably doesn't really matter very much, right? But for vitamin B3, certainly matters, right? Remember, pellagra, 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 right? Your 3 Ds, dermatitis, diarrhea, and dementia, right? And then the 4th D, I guess, is death. And don't forget your causes of pellagra, right? Basically, that's a niacin deficiency, right? So remember, there are many causes, right? So, like, for example, if you have like an amino acid reabsorption defect in the proximal tubule, right, where you cannot reabsorb tryptophan, then that's going to be a problem, right? Because tryptophan is used to make niacin, right? Or if you have something like carcinoid syndrome, where you're using a lot of your tryptophan to make serotonin, then you're not going to have enough left to make niacin. That can cause problems, right? So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind on exams, right? So pellagra, right? Keep that in mind with vitamin B3 deficiency, right? Vitamin B6 deficiency is one you definitely want to know about, right? Don't forget about neuropathy, right? With that, don't forget about seizures. Don't forget about sideroblastic anemia, right? Don't forget about the link to isoniazid, right? Remember, the neuropathy happens because, again, you need vitamin B6 to make neurotransmitters, right? So if you want to go from glutamate to GABA, you need vitamin B6, right? Glutamate decarboxylase is the thing that makes that conversion. You need vitamin B6 as a cofactor. Well, the thing is, vitamin B6 is used as a cofactor for glutamate decarboxylase, right? So if you don't have enough vitamin B6, you'll have more glutamate and less GABA, right? And remember, glutamate is an excitatory neurotransmitter, so that's going to cause you to have seizures, right? And then in terms of the sideroblastic anemia with B6 deficiency, don't forget the first step of heme synthesis, right? Where you take glycine and succinyl-CoA and make delta-aminolevulinic acid. That reaction requires aminolevulinic acid synthase, right? Remember, ALA synthase is the rate-limiting enzyme of heme synthesis. That enzyme uses vitamin B6 as a cofactor, right? So if you don't have enough vitamin B6, then heme synthesis is going to be impaired, and you're going to have sideroblastic anemia, right? And then, so again, don't forget the association with isoniazid. Isoniazid basically prevents the activation of vitamin B6, because vitamin B6, for it to work, it actually does need to get activated, right? It gets activated by a phosphokinase enzyme. That phosphokinase enzyme depends on vitamin B6 for functioning, right? So if you don't have enough vitamin B6, that phosphokinase is not going to work, right? So you're not going to activate B6. So it's almost like a functional vitamin B6 deficiency, right? And then remember, for your exams, don't forget vitamin B9 and folate deficiency, right? So like megaloblastic anemia, neurotube defects, don't forget that, right? Again, remember, the megaloblastic anemia arises because in the S phase of a DNA synthesis, right, like the synthesis phase of the cell cycle, the S phase, you need folate, right? Folate is absolutely necessary to make DNA, right? So when you have a folate deficiency, you're going to have impaired DNA production, and that's going to get you in trouble, right? And then also, don't forget your neurotube defects. You need a lot of folate for the proper development of the neurologic system, right? And then don't forget vitamin C, right? When you have a vitamin C deficiency, you're going to have issues with collagen, right? Remember C in vitamin C and C in collagen, right? Collagen needs vitamin C for its proper synthesis, right? So you're going to have things like scurvy. You're going to have things like poor wound healing. You're going to have things like bleeding gums, right? Keep that at the back of your mind for your exams, right? And then vitamin D, right? Think about it in terms of rickets, right? Rickets, rickets, rickets. Because you need vitamin D to help you mineralize osteoid, right? In your bones, right? So you're going to think bone problems, right? And remember, vitamin D helps you reabsorb calcium and phosphate in your gut. It really helps you maintain a good solubility product, right? So you're going to have things like rickets, osteomalacia, hypocalcemia, and things like that, right? Vitamin D deficiency is a very prominent cause of secondary hyperparathyroidism on your exams because you have hypocalcemia, right? So because if you don't reabsorb enough calcium from your gut, you'll have hypocalcemia. So you won't have negative feedback. So your PTH is gonna rise, right? And then remember, vitamin E deficiency, right, can cause hemolytic anemia, right? You're like, Divine, why would vitamin E deficiency cause hemolytic anemia? That doesn't make any sense. Well, let me explain. The thing is, vitamin E is necessary for the proper functioning of cell membranes, right? Proper function of cell membranes, right? So, if you have a vitamin E deficiency, you'll have improper red blood cell membranes, right? So those red blood cells are going to be less resistant to hemolysis. You're going to have a lot of hemolysis, right? In fact, remember that vitamin E deficiency on the USMLE exams is associated with acanthocytosis, right? And also vitamin E is also necessary for the proper functioning of myelin, right? Myelin needs vitamin E, right? So if you have a vitamin E deficiency, your myelin is going to be crap. And if your myelin is crap, you're going to have neurologic dysfunction, right? There are certain pathways that really depend on myelin, like your spinal cerebellar tract, right? So when you have a vitamin E deficiency, you may have ataxia because your spinal cerebellar tract doesn't work as well. Again, I know some of you may be like, man, Divine is just spitballing. But I promise you, many of these things I'm going over here, they're very, very high yield to know for your exams. The thing is, nutrition, the USMLEs are going to have a field day with this. Why? Because it reflects multi-systems processes and disorders, right? That's probably one of the hardest sections of the USMLEs to prepare for. All right. And then vitamin K deficiency, right? So don't forget the bleeding, right? Why would you bleed with vitamin K deficiency? Again, they can ask you about the mechanisms behind these things. It can be a nutrition question, but it's a mechanism question, right? Remember, you need vitamin K for vitamin K epoxide reductase to work. Well, what does vitamin K epoxide reductase do? Well, vitamin K epoxide reductase, it leads to the gamma carboxylation and activation of factors 2, 7, 9, and 10 and protein CNS, right? So if you have a vitamin K deficiency, those things are not going to work, right? Your clotting factors are basically not going to work, right? So your coagulation cascade is not going to work, right? So you're going to bleed, right? You're going to have an elevated PT, elevated PTT, and INR and things like that. All right. So don't forget, right? And how can you get these deficiencies? Remember, vitamins A, D, E, and K, those are your fat soluble vitamins. You can get those deficiencies if you have malabsorption for any reason, right? So say, for example, you have things like celiac disease, right? Or you have like Crohn's disease that is really messing up your small intestine, right? Or you see a person that has like, they've had gastric bypass, right? Gastric bypass has a very solid association with people developing or having malabsorption, especially if they're not wise and they don't take supplements like their physicians recommend that they do, right? And then remember, so keep those in mind for vitamins A, D, E, and K. And also, if you have pancreatic problems, right, you can also have fat-soluble vitamin deficiencies, right? Because remember, lipase does come from your pancreas, right? So if lipase comes from your pancreas and you have like a pancreas issue because you have cystic fibrosis or whatever, right, then you won't release lipase, right? Lipase is needed for the emulsification of fat. Lipase plays a role in you being able to reabsorb fat and fat-soluble vitamins, right? So that can cause problems, right? So, like, for example, people that have lipase problems are going to be people, for example, that have cystic fibrosis or people that have chronic pancreatitis, for example, on your exams, right? And then remember, the thiamine deficiency is going to be in an alcoholic or a gastric bypass patient or a person that is malnourished or a person that has an eating disorder, right? Like a person that has anorexia or a person that has bulimia, for example, right? I've kind of talked about the causes of vitamin B3 deficiency, right? B6, again, think of isoniazid, right? And then don't forget B12 with vegans, right? B12 with vegans. A vegan, a person that eats a lot of plant products, well, good luck, right? Or if you have like pernicious anemia, where you have autoimmune destruction of your parietal cells or intrinsic factor, that can also cause problems, right? Or if you have a terminal ileum problem like Crohn's disease, for example, remember Crohn's disease always affects the terminal ileum, right? So that can cause a B12 deficiency, right? So just keep that at the back of your mind for exams. And also one kind of weird thing that you may see on your test. I don't know why many resources don't talk about this, but this is metformin. Metformin can cause B12 deficiency. Metformin specifically inhibits the reabsorption of the B12 intrinsic factor complex in your terminal ileum, right? So metformin has a strong association with a vitamin B12 deficiency. That's something you certainly keep at the back of your mind for your exams, right? And then folate deficiency, again, you can think of that if you have like a poor diet or you're an alcoholic, right? So there's an enzyme that helps you reabsorb folate in the GI tract, right? In the jejunum of the GI tract, right? So if you have a if you're an alcoholic, alcohol inhibits that enzyme, right? So you're not going to be able to reabsorb folate. You're going to get in trouble with folate deficiency. And also, people can also have folate deficiency because they've had gastric bypass, right? Or you can also get folate deficiency because you're just using up your folate so fast, right? The thing is, it takes time to develop a B12 deficiency. It doesn't take very long to develop a folate deficiency because the thing is, B12, we have years of B12 in our bodies, right? But folate, we have like weeks of folate in our bodies, right? So if you lack folate, you're going to get in big trouble, right? So what are some situations that can make you use up folate? Well, for example, if a person has hemolytic anemia, let's say you have like sickle cell disease or you have hereditary spherocytosis, those people, they are always making new red blood cells, right? So because these people are always making new red blood cells, they use up their folate very fast, right? So if the average person maybe has like 10 weeks worth of folate, these people may have like 2 weeks worth of folate because they just use it so fast, right? So again, it's pretty high yield to know this for your exams, right? It's pretty high yield to know this for your exams. And then in terms of your, so those are the vitamins, right? Again, this is probably going to be something that's going to be a multi-part series, but we'll see. Let me just stuff in as much as I can with this podcast, right? So let's talk about minerals, right? So remember, iron deficiency. Don't forget that with, it can cause microcytic anemia, right? Because again, if you don't make enough iron, then your red blood cells will try to maintain a constant MCHC. I've explained this in previous podcasts, right? So your red blood cells, they have like a goal of maintaining a constant mean corpuscular hemoglobin concentration, right? So if you don't have enough heme, right, which is a problem you'll run into if you don't have enough iron, then your red blood cells have to get smaller to give you a constant MCHC, a constant mean corpuscular hemoglobin concentration, right? So that's the mechanism behind the microcytosis, right? So iron deficiency anemia is going to cause microcytosis, right? You're going to see things like pica, right? A person eating ice chips, eating sand and things like that. Koilonychia, right? Issues with the nails. Make sure you can identify koilonychia on your exams. It's spelled K-O-I-L-O-N-Y-C-H-I-A, right? And then don't forget like zinc deficiency. Zinc deficiency is going to cause poor wound healing. What's the other thing we've talked about that causes poor wound healing? Vitamin C, right? Remember vitamin C, right? So vitamin C, zinc, keep those in mind, right? Dysgeusia, right? So like impaired taste, alopecia, think of that with zinc deficiency. Iodine deficiency, right? Remember, you can see iodine deficiency, you know, just from, again, a poor diet, right? You can also see an iodine deficiency from a person taking a drug like amiodarone, for example, right? So it can cause hypothyroidism, it can cause goiter, right? And then again, if you have a calcium vitamin D deficiency, right? Calcium is a mineral, vitamin D is a vitamin, right? It can cause bone problems, right? And then remember, magnesium deficiency, very, very common in alcoholics, right? Alcohol specifically inhibits the reabsorption of magnesium in your GI tract, right? So that can certainly cause problems, right? So remember, hypomagnesemia, that can cause arrhythmias, like it can prolong your QT, can lead to VTAC, VFib, torsade de pointe, right? You can have seizures from hypomagnesemia, and it can also cause hypocalcemia and hypokalemia, right? Because remember, the transporters in your body that help you hold on to calcium and potassium, they depend on magnesium for proper functioning, right? So if you have hypomagnesemia, those things are not necessarily going to work very, very well, right? So again, the USMLEs, they just like to, because I know some people just see, oh, the USMLEs are going to test nutrition. And then they just kind of narrow their minds to, oh, nutrition, okay, they're just going to, no, like they're going to integrate it with biochem, they're going to integrate it with heme, they're going to integrate it with neuro, they're going to integrate it with pregnancy, with pediatrics, with GI, with pharmacology. That's how they're going to integrate it, right? So again, like just be smart about this, right? So on your exams, one thing you want to kind of keep in mind, I guess, is this whole concept of a nutrition vital sign, right? Nutrition vital sign. You know, kind of like we take vital signs when you come into the hospital, right? You know, we check your blood pressure, we check your heart rate, we check your respiratory rate, we check your oxygen saturation or whatever. Well, the thing is, there are certain people you should obtain nutrition vital signs on, right? So who are these classic people? You may be surprised that you'll get a question on your exams and the right answer will just be to obtain a nutrition vital sign, right? So who are these people? Well, these are going to be people that have like weight loss, right? People that have chronic diseases, right? People that have food insecurity, right? You know, they're like people that live in poverty, right? Trust me, I understand what that means. I certainly lived in poverty, just my grown-up years lived in quite a bit of poverty there. Growing up in Nigeria was a tough life, right? But people that have GI disease, right? People that have, like, for example, Crohn's disease, or people that have had gastric bypass, right? Keep those people in mind. People on GLP-1 agonists, right? Especially if they're not smart about their diets, they can also develop nutritional deficiencies, right? People that have alcohol use disorder. You see all the things I've talked about that's linked to alcohol, right? Like B1 deficiency, right? Thiamine deficiency, magnesium deficiency, and things like that, right? People that have had, again, bariatric surgery, people that have cancer, right? People that are pregnant, right? The thing is, these different populations, they all have like specific nutritional needs. People that have renal disease, people that are frail, right? Always keep this at the back of your mind, right? So what are the components of a nutritional vital sign? Well, you should typically ask them, like, hey, what's your diet like, right? What do you usually eat in a typical day, right? Have you had any recent weight loss or weight gain, right? Do you run out of food? Are you worried about where the next meal is going to come from, right? Do you have any nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, you know? Do you have, like, restrictive eating patterns, right? You should always ask these things. Are there any supplements you take? Any special diets you take? Are you on weight loss medications, right? That's like GLP-1 agonist, for example, right? Or do you have any cultural or religious food practices, right? These are all things you ask about when you're assessing a person's nutritional vital signs, right? And the thing is, our friends at the MBMEs, sometimes they like to give you a question on the exam where they match it to a physical exam finding, right? So they'll either give you a question about a deficiency and they want you to pick up the physical exam finding that's associated with it, or give you a bunch of physical exam findings and want you to pick up the nutritional deficiency that's associated with that, right? So, for example, right, keep in mind, like, what are some strange, we've kind of talked about some of these, right? But what are some physical exam findings you should keep in mind? Think of temporal wasting, right? Temporal wasting should make you think of a person that probably has cancer or something along those lines, right? Muscle loss. Think of a person that's on a GLP-1 agonist, right? Or a person that has, like, rapid weight loss, right? Remember, when you're losing weight, it's not just fat you're losing, you're also losing muscle. That's why many times it's recommended that you take a lot of protein and you also do a lot of strength or resistance training, right? Edema. Edema on physical exam can be a sign that a person is hypoalbuminemic, right? It can be a sign that a person has liver disease, because remember, you need albumin to maintain adequate amounts of oncotic pressure in the body, right? So, like, if they have edema, right, that should get you down, like, that low albumin pathway, right? So it can tell you that maybe they have nephrotic syndrome, or maybe they have, like, a protein restricted diet, maybe they have, like, kwashiorkor, for example, right? Or they have a liver problem, right? So keep that in mind, right? Poor wound healing should make you think of vitamin C deficiency, and should make you think of a zinc deficiency, right? And the thing is, many of these vitamin deficiencies, especially the B vitamins, they can cause things like glossitis, they can cause keloids, so, like, cracking of the lips, right? Neuropathy, you see neuropathy, think of a B6 deficiency, think of a B12 deficiency, right? B6 deficiency and a B1, B6 and B12 deficiency. B1, B6 and B12 deficiency, right? And also think of a vitamin E deficiency as well with neuropathy, right? Remember that spinal cerebellar tract business that I kind of talked about, right? You see a person that has, like, easy bruising, think of scurvy and vitamin C deficiency. You see skin changes, again, think of scurvy and a vitamin C deficiency, right? And also think of, for skin changes, also do not forget, pelagra, right? Pelagra, yeah, vitamin B3, niacin deficiency, right? I remember also poor wound healing, don't forget zinc, right? So kind of keep these at the back of your mind. Alopecia, think of, you see a person losing their hair, think of a zinc deficiency, right? Think of a zinc deficiency. Yeah, that's the thing with this nutrition. There's just so many ways they can basically put you in trouble on your exams, right? And typically when you're worried about these people that have these nutritional problems, what are some key labs you want to get? You want to get like a CBC, right? To assess them for anemia, CMP, to assess them for electrolyte abnormalities, right? Go ahead and check their albumin, right? Go ahead and check their albumin, check their prealbumin, right? Check their iron studies, B12 levels, folate levels, vitamin D levels, magnesium, phosphate, calcium, zinc, right? Look at their A1C, look at their lipids, right? So again, just keep that at the back of your mind for your exams, right? And then let's talk about this whole thing about food insecurity, right? This is probably one of the highest yield themes on the exams, right? So, you know, food insecurity is basically like having limited access to enough food. And not just enough food, but like nutritious food, right? Nutritious food, right? So food insecurity is where you have limited access to enough food. And then nutrition insecurity is where you have limited access to food that supports health. So you want to know the difference between these two things. Food insecurity is, I don't have access to enough food. Nutrition insecurity is, I don't have access to nutritious food, food that's actually healthy, that makes me have good health, right? These are things you're going to find in a food desert, for example, right? Where it's like, ooh, they have all this fast food around. They have McDonald's. They have all these things around, right? But then they don't have like good grocery stores that sell like healthy foods, and they just have convenience stores and fast food, right? Convenience stores and fast food, right? So the thing is, just be careful. The fact that you're consuming calories does not mean that it's nutritious calories, right? The fact that you have calories does not mean you have nutritious calories, right? And the thing is, sometimes on your exams, they'll give you these questions where you have to pick out statements as your answer, right? So like, for example, if you want to assess a person for food or nutritional insecurity, you can ask them like, hey, in the last 12 months, were you worried, you know, that food would run out before you had money to buy more, right? Or in the last 12 months, did you buy food that did the food you buy not last, right? Or you don't have money to get more, you know, just basically assessing like, hey, do you have enough money to buy food, right? Do you have enough money to buy food, right? And the thing is, on your exams, beyond this screening, it is very high yield to know that you should refer these people to programs that can help with their food insecurity, right? So what are some of these programs? Well, the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition assistance program, right? So you should make sure you know about that. The WIC program, Women, Infants, and Children program, you should know about that, right? Food pantries, food banks, right? You should certainly know about those things, right? Even one kind of weird thing that they love to test on the exams is that when people are placed on a GLP-1 agonist, there's nothing wrong with pairing them up with a registered dietitian, right? With a registered dietitian, right? And then the thing is, if you want people to make behavioral changes, right? Because again, this is another big thing with nutrition, right? You want people to make behavioral changes. The thing is, our friends and the MBMEs, they want you to use certain tools, right? So like, for example, motivational interviewing is a big one, right? And also they want you to use SMART goals. I know some of you are like, oh, Divine, this is like gibberish. Again, SMART goals, you do need to know, right? I know many of you know this already, right? Specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, time-bound. You got to know those things for your exams, right? So like, for example, believe it or not, you may be like, Divine, how would they ever test a SMART goal on the exams? Well, they will give you a question where a person wants to make a lifestyle change in terms of just healthier eating. And then our friends at the MBMEs, what they'll do is they'll give you a series of answers. And an answer will reflect a SMART goal. And then you'll see a bunch of answers that, you know, they're very non-specific recommendations like move more. Again, they're not going to put move more, right? But eat a healthier meal or stop consuming soda and things like that. And then there will be an answer that reflects this SMART, algorithm, right? So like, for example, if you tell a patient, hey, replace soda with water at lunch 5 days this week, that's SMART, right? It is specific, it is measurable, it's achievable, it's relevant, and it's time bound, right? So just make sure that when you're giving patients advice on nutrition, right, make sure that it reflects this SMART mantra. That's the classic way they go after SMART goals on your exams, right? And then another thing I'm going to talk about, again, that's the thing, annoying thing about this nutrition of a thing is, it's kind of like a grab bag of just different topics, right? So just make sure you know about a metabolic syndrome, right? So remember, metabolic syndrome, what are the key components of the metabolic syndrome, right? Central obesity, right? High blood pressure, high triglycerides, low HDL, and elevated fasting glucose, right? Again, please don't be wise on your exams. LDL is not like, oh, high LDL is not part of the metabolic syndrome criteria. It's low HDL that is part of it, right? And the thing is, on your exams, they'll want you to pick nutritional interventions for people that have the metabolic syndrome, right? So what should these people do? Well, they should reduce the consumption of beverages that contain a ton of sugar, right? They should eat more fiber, right? Make sure you emphasize that, hey, in your diet, make sure you're having vegetables, fruits, legumes, whole grains, nuts, things like that, right? And then always go for fats that are unsaturated, over like saturated or trans fat, right? Limit ultra processed foods, right? Reduce sodium, right? Again, a low sodium diet is very helpful for people that have high blood pressure and people that have heart failure in your test, right? People that have what? High blood pressure, the two H's, right? High blood pressure, heart failure on your test, right? And again, if a person wants to lose weight, they should basically like be in a calorie deficit, right? And again, remember on your exams, they can test between the two kinds of fat. Remember, there is the visceral fat, right, that's around your organs, and then there's the one that's like subcutaneous and whatnot. The one that's the most dangerous is the visceral fat, right? So keep that at the back of your mind for your exams, right? Keep that at the back of your mind for your exams, right? And then again, I've kind of talked about this, but I think I should just highlight this just for you to look out for these patient populations on your test, right? The thing is, for these nutrition questions, there are so many things you need to combine together to get these questions right on your exams, right? But who are the patients that are at high risk for developing nutritional problems on your exams? People that are old, right? They may not have a good diet. People that have cancer, right? They may not want to eat. People that have chronic GI disorders, like inflammatory bowel disease, bariatric surgery patients, things like that, right? People that have alcohol use disorder. I've talked about the deficiencies they can develop. Eating disorders, right? Anorexia, bulimia, right? Post-op patients, people that are post-op, right? ICU patients, right? Remember, ICU patients, many of them can have to be on TPN or something like that, right? People that have food insecurity, people that have dysphagia, people that have like an esophageal problem, people that have CKD, right? CKD can make you develop a vitamin D deficiency, because remember, 1-alpha hydroxylase, the enzyme that converts calcidiol to calcitriol, we find it in the kidneys, right? So people that have CKD, people that have heart failure, people that have cirrhosis, right? Remember, cirrhosis is a sort of hypoalbuminemia, right? So just keep this at the back of your mind for your exams, right? And then remember, when people start, if you get a question on your exams about a person that, you know, has one of these problems, right? Or is in one of these patient populations, and then they get on a proper diet, especially maybe let's say they get admitted to the hospital. Usually this is going to be a hospital-based problem, right? They get admitted to the hospital, and then you notice that this person starts having like arrhythmias, you know, you start feeding them, they start having arrhythmias and all these issues, right? And they become unconscious, unresponsive, and then they die. If you see something like this, I really want you to think of, I really want you to think about refeeding syndrome, right? So remember, what's the most common cause of death in refeeding syndrome? It's going to be low phosphate, right? Because again, when you start eating after a period of starvation slash fasting or poor nutrition, then insulin is going to get released in like huge gobs, right? And as you release tons of insulin, you're going to drive a lot of phosphate into your cells. That's going to cause hypophosphatemia, right? Many people think hypophosphatemia is benign. No, it's not. It can actually kill you, right? So like literally the most common cause of death, very high yield, the most common cause of death in refeeding syndrome is low phosphate, right? And remember other labs, right, that you can get if you have hypophosphatemia, right? It can, you know, cause, you know, low potassium, low magnesium, right? You can have thiamine deficiency, right? You can have all these fluid shifts, right? So just be careful, right? These people, you may want to supplement these electrolytes, and you may want to do like gradual reintroduction of food instead of giving them like big time amounts of food, right? You know, like when a person is done fasting, you know, you've probably had this experience, right? Like when you're like, you've done like a long fast and you just want to eat out the wazoo, right? Well, don't eat out the wazoo because you're going to have problems, right? You may notice that if you eat a big, large meal after you've had a fast, you notice that you kind of feel dizzy and all those things. Believe it or not, it's electrolyte abnormalities you have. You have like very mild refeeding syndrome kind of going on there, right? So keep that at the back of your mind for your exams. All right. Now, what's another high yield thing that they love to test with nutrition on the USMLEs? I'm going to see if I can pack in everything with this podcast. Let me try my best. So it's going to be a long one, right? So just buckle up, right? Again, on your exams, they like you to know some drug nutrient interactions, right? You definitely want to know these things, right? So don't forget, like if you're on warfarin, remember warfarin can you want to make sure you're taking consistent amounts of vitamin K, right? Make sure you're taking consistent amounts of vitamin K. Don't have your vitamin K levels be all over the map, right? When you're taking warfarin, just be consistent so that after a while, your body kind of finds a good level of iron and kind of keeps you there, right? Remember isoniazid and B6 deficiency, right? So if a person is taking isoniazid, they should be taking pyridoxal phosphate, right? Metformin, remember, metformin can cause a B12 deficiency, right? And then don't forget your proton pump inhibitors. PPIs, you know, people kind of give them out like candy in hospitals, but I'm like, gee, what are these people doing? If you don't need a PPI, you shouldn't be on a PPI because it causes a bunch of problems, right? It can cause B12 deficiency, right? Because remember, PPIs reduce the acidity of your stomach, and that pH of your stomach is actually very necessary for you to separate B12 from the food that you consume, right? So the thing is, for B12 to marry intrinsic factor, it needs to be separated from the animal product that you consumed. You need that hyperacidity of the stomach for that to happen. Well, PPIs kind of shut down that hyperacidity. So that can get you in quite a bit of trouble, right? So PPIs can cause B12 deficiency. They can cause MAG deficiency because magnesium sometimes is reabsorbed in the stomach, right? And again, it's a pH sensitive process, right? So if you have an altered pH of your stomach as happens when you take a PPI, that can impair magnesium absorption, right? It can even cause calcium problems, right? So again, PPI is B12, magnesium, and calcium, right? And then remember, loop diuretics, right? Your loops, your thiazides, they can cause your loops. Let me focus on your loops first, right? So loops lose calcium, right? So loops can cause you to have hypocalcemia, hypokalemia, right? They can cause hypomagnesemia, right? Remember, loops, they make you volume depleted, right? So that's going to crank up the activity of your renin angiotensin aldosterone system. And when you crank up the activity of that system, right? You're going to start losing a lot of potassium in your urine, right? You're going to have hypokalemia because remember, aldosterone makes you excrete potassium, right? So just keep that at the back of your mind, right? And then remember, thiazides can cause hypercalcemia. They can cause hypokalemia, right? Remember, thiazides are like loops that make you lose calcium. Thiazides help you reabsorb a lot of calcium. So thiazides may actually be good for people that have osteoporosis, if you have osteoporosis and high blood pressure, right? And then don't forget your ACE inhibitors, your ARBs, your spironolactone, which is an aldosterone receptor antagonist. They can cause a hyperkalemia, right? And then don't forget statins, right? Remember the grapefruit juice interaction, right? So grapefruit prevents the breakdown of your statins, right? So your statin levels can really rise and that can be a problem. Then don't forget your monoamine oxidase inhibitors, right? With a thyramine hypertensive crisis. Don't forget levothyroxine. Levothyroxine can be chelated heavily by a lot of stuff, right? So don't take your Synthroid when you're taking calcium or iron, right? Just be careful, right? Just be careful there. And then remember your tetracyclines and your fluoroquinolones, right? Again, don't take them with things that can chelate them and reduce their bioavailability like calcium, iron, and magnesium, right? And again, don't forget alcoholism. I'm telling you, like, it's going to be really strange for the USMLEs to write a nutrition exam and not include alcoholics, right? Alcoholism causes a bunch of problems, right? So don't forget your alcohol with thiamine deficiency, folate deficiency, and a B6 deficiency, right? And then I think one other thing you should keep at the back of your mind, right, is the difference between food allergy and food intolerance, right? So food allergy versus a food intolerance, right? So remember, food allergy is immune mediated, right? is immune mediated, right? So typically the person, what are some classic symptoms you're going to see in those people on your exams? You're going to see things like urticaria. They're going to be itching a lot. They're going to have angioedema. They're going to have wheezing, vomiting, low blood pressure, anaphylaxis, right? And obviously, right, if they have anaphylactic shock, right, you're going to go ahead and treat them with intramuscular epinephrine, right? Not intravenous epinephrine, guys. Please be careful. Please, please, please. I've seen too many people make this mistake on the USMLEs. Don't join those ranks. Don't join those ranks, right? Please, 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 right? You don't give intravenous epinephrine for anaphylaxis. No, no, right? You know, no, right? That's for arrhythmias, guys. Please, for your exams, for a person has anaphylaxis, give them intramuscular epinephrine, right? Seems like a small point, but I've seen too many medical students get sacrificed by this on the exams, right? And then, so food allergy, that's what I've just described. Right? How about food intolerance? Food intolerance is non-immune. It is not immune-mediated, right? Typically, it's going to be caused by like some kind of enzyme deficiency, right? So like, for example, if a person has a lactase deficiency, which is very common in African Americans and also very common in Asians, they can have a lactose intolerance, right? Typically, when people have food intolerance, they're going to have like bloating, gas, diarrhea, abdominal pain after they eat a meal. That's very different from urticaria, angioedema, wheezing, and things like that. They're not going to have anaphylaxis, right? So again, be careful about that. A person consumes milk, they have bloating afterwards. That's going to be food intolerance. That's going to be food intolerance, right? And again, remember, I talked about the pregnant population earlier. Remember, if you're pregnant, right? If you're pregnant, encourage breastfeeding as much as is possible, right? Literally encourage breastfeeding as much as is possible, right? You know, breastfeeding is very helpful. It has so many benefits for the child, right? It reduces the child's risk of asthma, allergies, diabetes, cancer, right? Many amazing things that breastfeeding does for people, right? And remember, if a woman is pregnant, right? If a woman is breastfeeding or she's pregnant, you know, she should take folic acid, especially when pregnant, so you reduce the risk of neural tube defects, right? When you're pregnant, you're going to need more iron, right? You're going to need more iron. You're going to need more iron because your blood volume goes up. You need iron to make that extra blood. You should avoid alcohol while you're pregnant, right? Because alcoholism can cause, you know, fetal alcohol syndrome, and there's no safe level of alcohol during pregnancy, right? Avoid fish, consuming like big amounts of fish, right? Especially fish that tends to be very high in mercury, right? And again, remember, if a woman has like morning sickness, remember to give her vitamin B6 and doxylamine, right? Because again, that morning sickness can make people start developing nutritional deficiencies, right? Nutritional deficiencies. And then don't forget about gestational diabetes. Again, that's another thing they love to test in that arena, right? And then remember, if an infant is being exclusively breastfed, that infant has to get a vitamin D supplementation, because breast milk, I'm sorry, is not very rich in vitamin D, right? It's not very rich in vitamin D. And again, remember, do not give honey to a child that is underage one because of the risk of botulism, right? Because again, remember, as a you know, newborns, they don't have any GI flora, right? So if you consume honey, right, you're going to consume the spores, and then the spores, since you have no GI flora, there's literally like no competition for a newborn, right? So those spores are going to germinate, you're going to make toxin inside the GI tract of the fetus, and then the child is going to develop botulism and be a floppy baby, right? So you don't want that, right? You don't want that, right? So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind, right? And then one other rule I'm going to talk about on your exams: if your gut works, use it. If your gut works, use it, right? So in general, if possible, always go with enteral nutrition, especially if you have a functional GI tract, right? But, you know, just for whatever reason, you have inadequate oral intake, go for enteral nutrition, right? So like, for example, although there are some risks with enteral nutrition, right? Like you can aspirate, you can have diarrhea, the tube can be poorly placed and all those things, right? So generally, after you place like a feeding tube, make sure you do like an abdominal radiograph just to confirm a proper placement, right? So when should you use TPN on your exam? So you should use TPN where, for whatever reason, the GI tract is not usable, right? So like, for example, if a person has like really severe bowel obstruction or short bowel syndrome, right? Or they have like terrible, terrible, terrible ileus, or they have like a high output fistula, right? Or you've tried enteral tube feeding and it's not working, then in that case, you can consider a TPN, right? But remember, TPN can be associated with a bunch of problems, right? So like a catheter-associated infection. I mean, you're literally putting food into a catheter. What do you think is going to happen? Like, literally, what do you think is going to happen there? Of course, the bugs are also going to want that food, right? So you can have like a central line associated bloodstream infection with that. You can have like thrombosis of the catheter, right? You can develop like cholestasis in the liver, right? You can have like acalculus cholecystitis from that. You can develop refeeding syndrome, right? So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind for exams, right? So again, please, 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 all these things I've kind of talked about, right? You know, these key themes, make sure you know them, right? Make sure you know them. I'm telling you these things, you're going to see these things pop up on your exams. You're going to see these things pop up on your exams, right? So again, the USMLEs, they're kind of moving away from just like the facts with like these isolated deficiencies to more like just clinical application, right? So again, you still need to know some of your step one classic knowledge, but honestly, you need to start knowing all these other side things, right? So, and that's the thing that sometimes people hate about these, my podcast, that, oh, Divine, you're kind of going in this direction, this direction, this direction, this direction. The thing is, that's the reality of your exams, right? Again, the fact that something is nice and clean does not make it nice and good, right? Nice and clean doesn't always mean nice and good, right? It's like, for example, if you go through drive-through, it's easy, right? You go through drive-through at a food place, it's easy, right? But most times that food is garbage, right? So that's the thing. Like, the thing is, for me, whenever I make podcasts, my goal is to try to make it as integrative as possible, because that's the reality of the USMLE exams. That's the truth, right? So I'm not going to spoon feed facts to you. No, that's not my goal with this podcast. If you want someone to spoon feed facts to you, you should not be listening to this podcast. You should consult some other resource that is cleaner for you, right? But the fact that something is clean does not necessarily make it helpful for you, right? Because on the USMLE exams, the facts are not going to be presented to you in a clean fashion, right? They're going to go with multiple integrations, right? Pull many things together, right? So the thing is, you need to get comfortable with this uncomfortable method of thinking so that you're well prepared for your exams. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and stop here. If you like the way I teach, you're going to love my classes. I teach a bunch of classes over Zoom. I have a 20-hour step two, step three class. I have a 50-hour step two, step three class. I have a last minute review that's for step two, step three. I have a biostats class. I have a social science, ethics, and quality improvement class. I have a test-taking class. So these last three classes, biostats, social sciences, and test-taking strategies class, that's for step one to step three, right? And then I also offer tutoring for like shelf exams, medical school exams, COMLEX exams. Board exams for like internal medicine and stuff, I do offer tutoring for those. So if you're interested, just shoot me an email. I can give you some more information. I make study plans for people and also help with things like ERAS applications, personal statements, recommendation letters, and things of that nature. I've actually started working with people for the 2026, 2027 cycle. I feel like before I used to worry about that kind of work like June, but now it's like people are beginning to work on the applications earlier because this process is just becoming more and more competitive every year. All right. And then I have these podcasts on Apple, Google, and Spotify. So if you're interested, just check that out. And then I also have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. So many of you know I'm a Christ follower. So every week I post like one or two podcasts where from a biblical perspective I address a life lesson. I have almost 400 podcasts on there. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. And then remember, I do have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos, where I sometimes post videos and podcasts that I make. So thank you for listening to me today. I will see you, God willing, episode 651. But again, listen to this podcast. You're going to see this material on your exam, whether you like it or not. All right, so have a wonderful day. God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.